what tool would I use to solve a problem, whether it's AI or not, right? We always start with business problem definition. We always start with what type of quick wins can I get with the tools and technologies and processes that are available. We don't bank on, okay, well, I have blockchain, so let's just apply it anywhere I can. It's more of, here's a business problem. By the way, I know about the technology, and now I can put the two and two together. We are also the largest identity holders with, as you can imagine, with 34 million identities of Californians out of the 39 million Californians that are there. What we ended up doing was we introduced AI, which reduced the time for decision-making, keeping in mind that we always had human in the loop because we want to make sure the decision is still made by a human, but faster. So now they are not Googling away and trying to figure it out.
Welcome to the Chief AI Officer Podcast,
where AI meets leadership.
And here is your host, Sanjay Puri.
Welcome to the CIO Podcast, where we explore the journeys, insights, and challenges of Chief AI Officers and enterprise AI leaders who are driving transformation in large organizations. I'm your host, Sanjay Puri, and today we are honored to have Ajay Gupta with us. Ajay serves as the Chief Digital Transformation Officer for the state of California, where he was specifically appointed by the governor's office to transform the California Department of Motor Vehicles into a world-class customer service organization through innovations in data and automation. With over 25 years of experience spanning enterprise architecture, systems integration, and digital transformation, Ajay has become a pioneering force in government AI implementation. Under his leadership, California has become a global trailblazer in digital identity solutions, implementing the nation's most advanced mobile driver's license program and leveraging AI for intelligent automation and even exploring blockchain technology for vehicle title management. His work has earned California multiple international awards, including recognition from Gartner's ION Innovation Awards and AMWA's International Innovation Awards. He's worked in the public sector, but before that, he spent two decades in consulting with firms like Deloitte, KPMG, and managing large-scale government technology implementations. Today, we're going to dive deep into his remarkable journey from private sector to government innovation, and learn how he's building the future of digital government services for nearly 40 million Californians. Ajay, welcome to the CIO Podcast.
Sanjay, happy to be here.
Great. Ajay, we have a global audience. A lot of them happen to be your peers who are listening in, working in companies, enterprises, Fortune 500 companies, chief AI officers, CIOs, CTOs. And then there are people working for them. Then we have entrepreneurs, we have policy leaders, etc. So to begin, can you just tell them a little bit about your journey? I kind of laid very briefly. You made a pretty significant career transition from private sector consulting to leading digital transformation in government. What inspired you to make the move, and how's the experience differed from expectations?
Yeah, it's been interesting and a lot of fun so far. So very happy with my decision that I made about 6 years ago, mostly out of need by the state and by invitation. So I've worked in public sector while I've been on the private sector side for many years. I've worked in public sector, primarily serving public sector customers across the US, East Coast, West Coast, Hawaii, or very West Coast, Hawaii. So it's always been my passion working in the public sector, providing solutions, helping. I was in health and human services, so helping people in social benefit programs, and also a little bit of financial sector, a little bit of retirement, and now in transportation. So it's been fun. Now, 6 years ago, I was in touch with the Health and Human Services secretary then, who just kind of offered that, why don't you come and work for the state? I'm like, well, this could be interesting because a lot of times I'm pitching ideas on how to help the state, but it's always banking on somebody else to make the decision. So maybe it'll be great to be the decision maker and take the state in the direction that I feel would be great for the state and really create an example for other public sector entities. So, and then coincidentally, the state CIO called me for helping out, and the governor of GovOps, what we call the government operations secretary, also liked what I had to say, they invited me to join the state. And I, since then, I've been loving what I'm doing. And in terms of expectations, your second part of the question on how is it different? So a lot of times there is sort of a general perception that state government works in a very slow, very bureaucratic direction, which is true in many cases, but not true always. And I hope we have set that example in the work that we have done in the last 6 years. When I came in, I had some of that jaded view. I was working in public sector for a while, so I kind of knew how to leverage certain aspects of things to move things faster. But I think I completely got lucky that me and the director almost joined at the same time, and director also came from private sector as well. Mm. He wasn't truly private sector. He had never done any public sector work. Mm-hmm. So we together were able to change the pace of change, the pace of change that we wanted at the DMV and also within the state as well. So that gave me sort of a sponsorship and also a way to be the sounding board, both sides, to make sure that we make the right decision, we take the right level of risk, but go at a pace that's unprecedented. And on top of that, we did hit COVID around that same time as well, which allowed us to take advantage of the unfortunate opportunity that was presented to us. And we were able to trailblaze through a lot of it. So expectation wise, it's been way faster. And I can tell you that I'm doing more personal time investment into my work than I've ever done, even in private sector. So the pace has been unprecedented. So that's the difference of what I thought when I come in, which will be decent pace, but this is crazily different, but in a good way.
In a good way. Well, that I think is great to know, because a lot of our listeners are in the private sector and people always wonder how it is going to be on the other side. And I think what you're saying is actually you're pretty surprised. And in fact, the pace has been fantastic. And we're going to talk about some of the amazing things you've done in the short 6 years. Ajay, you were there during COVID, but you were also there when ChatGPT came out. Just for our listeners, what was the aha moment that you had that this was going to be something big, something different, whether it is for the state, for technology, or for just everybody? Just tell our listeners a little bit about that aha moment that you had.
Yeah, so mine, let's call it a little bit more balanced viewpoint on new technologies than others would have. I've gone through many hype cycles, including the hype cycle that was associated with blockchain and now with large language models as well. It's not going to be able to solve all the problems of the world. So very carefully looking at what things are good at, and what are the things we should be cautious about, has always been this balanced viewpoint on whenever new tech is introduced, right? Whether it was early 2000s when mobile technologies were coming about, blockchain, AI or machine learning, and then big data was a big thing for a while, but all those normalize after the hype cycle dips down. So the first thought for me was, because we were already at DMV, we're already delving with AI in general. We had, I want to say, between 6 to 10 AI different artificial intelligence or machine learning initiatives already at DMV helping our customers, whether it's related to document processing, interactive interviews, scheduling optimization, customer support, fraud analytics, those are all in place. There were certain things about generative nature of the AI that were interesting, but that also came with the caveat that what it may be generating, as you know, at this point in time, where is the content coming from? Can we trust it? There have been a lot of failed experiments in the past as well with AI when it's trying to generate things that perhaps doesn't have any guardrails around it. So while we looked at it and we already had use cases for large language models, we worked with a few principles. We worked with the principle that while we can enjoy the new features that it's offering, we want to put in the right guardrails in place as it's evolving. As you know, it's still evolving. The ChatGPT version 5 just came out. Claude had new version just come out as well, but they are evolving, they're changing, and each revision has certain good and bad with it, and then there is increments. So in general, right-sizing that expectation was extremely important for us. The aha moment for me, as it relates to the LLM, was that it actually truly ingested all this large set of information, which I can take advantage of. And there's some examples that I'd be happy to talk about how we ended up using it. We are using portions of the generative pieces, but we are actually taking advantage of the plain simple fact that these models are built on this plethora of information that we can utilize to solve some of our real world problems.
Fantastic. So you take a very nuanced, balanced approach. So let's get into something that I think has gotten international recognition. Now, I told our listeners I'm not going to make any DMV jokes. We're going to talk about AI and DMV. So California's mobile driver's license program, as I said, has gotten a lot of recognition. Walk our listeners through the AI and technology components that makes this system so innovative and what problems it solves for California residents, Ajay.
Yeah, so very passionate about this topic, but I do want to start by saying my objective here at the DMV is to make sure that people lose the funny part of those jokes because they know they are no longer jokes, the DMV jokes, right? The goal is to stay away from the news. The goal is to make sure we provide the customer service that's not just great in the government sector, but also really in the retail sector across all industry sectors. So to become that world leader in providing retail services, we get 17 million visitors a year in our field, 180 field offices, 75 million transactions performed annually. We send out 90 million pieces of paper, which I want to reduce, by the way, but and then receive, you know, rather large number of incoming letters as well. So the operation is huge. The operation is vast given the California population. We are also the largest identity holders, with, as you can imagine, with 34 million identities of Californians out of the 39 million Californians that are there. So from that standpoint, the digital identity, the mobile identity initiative that we have, it's a statewide initiative where we have created a cryptographically secure version of your driver license or identity card in form of what we call as an MDL, mobile driver license, but it actually does include identity card as well. So it doesn't need to be specific to driver licenses. On your mobile device, which has the security, as you know, it has biometric verification feature. It has a secure lockbox area. There you can store your private keys, et cetera, that cannot be copied or cloned, et cetera. So we are taking advantage of all of that and other device features like the camera and the Bluetooth that's available on it to, first of all, verify who you are. So essentially for anybody who has a driver license or ID card with California can ask for a mobile driver license sitting from the comfort of their home. All they have to do is scan their driver license, scan their face. What we do in the background is a whole lot of AI magic to make sure that you're real, you're you, you're here. And that's extremely important. You're not the copy of Sanjay, right? A picture of Sanjay that somebody's trying to scan from a website and call it good. We actually verify you're live, you're real. We verify it is you based on our records, based on the picture that is presented. We verify the authenticity of the card that's scanned, etc. And we verify the device aspects too, like, is it rooted or not? So all in all, there is many different factors that are validated to make sure we are not issuing identity to a fraudster. Using a set of AI technologies, we are able to then match, verify the liveness, match the information, match the data that's provided, and then issue an identity to you. So that's the issuance part of the ecosystem that we have created. And then there is the verification part of the ecosystem that's created using ISO specifications, which also uses the readily available technologies that are on mobile phone, like your face ID or your biometrics matching, to then unlock the so nobody else except Sanjay can unlock it based on what you know and what you have, which is your face or your fingerprint or a PIN code perhaps that you may have, and then present it both in person, like at TSA at the airports and California convenience stores for age verification, or at a soccer stadium to buy, you know, age verified products, alcohol, etc. Or online, like at DMV website, you can actually log in using your mobile driver license, so it knows who you are. And the same is becoming true for other state provided services, where this identity will provide a cheaper, less frictiony alternative to more expensive technologies that require us to do third-party verification, etc., when we establish identity. So that presentation part is also full of this high-tech, cryptographically safe, public key infrastructure-based validation before the verifiers could trust you and give you services, you know, in exchange for that identity verification.
Wow, that's a lot. Because there is security and then there is services. So just, Ajay, just a couple of questions now. As someone who, you know, uses a driver license, I use a physical one, unfortunately, because I'm not a California resident. The DMV serves every resident. So how do you stress test AI models for, you know, edge cases, such as for language diversity, disability access? How are you doing that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I want to say it's work in progress. California does have a lot of diversity, right? Whether you call it race, gender, mm-hmm. ethnicity, geographic diversity as well. Number one, for the biometrics matching part, we actually bank quite a bit on our friends from the federal government, right? The Department of Homeland Security, Science and Technology teams, the NIST team, etc. So NIST actually has laid out a lot of algorithms that we believe are more equitable. They have tested them for gender, for race, for ethnicity, for the geographical, essentially equality, and we look for what both false positive and false negatives to decide which algorithm worked best for this very diverse California environment. And that's what we have always focused on. We have focused on the fact that we provide equitable solutions, and this is no different. Now, in terms of using AI for making decisions, I think that's very controversial field in general. So we have always banked on more responsible AI in terms of, yes, it does have testing done. So we have worked on third-party tools like the NIST's facial recognition verification test system. They have millions of records and algorithms ranked for it. Then we have third-party independent verification for what we call as presentation attack detection. We are not only worried about equitable nature of the services, but also fraud preventive nature of the services as well, especially when it comes to remote identity. Now, from equity standpoint, we have worried about our disadvantaged population, disadvantaged because they are disabled, or disadvantaged because they may be not digitally literate to be able to take on a selfie, you know, do some other things. We don't assume that everybody can handle the phone the way millennials and Gen Zers can. So we've actually provided issuance of this remote identity as part of our field office identity issuance service. So not only you'll get, so imagine the world where you come into the field office, you have a plane to catch, and you don't have a driver license. While the driver license plastic card would arrive in a couple of weeks, because that's how much it takes to create that secure plastic identity for you and mail it to you, we can actually give you a mobile driver license the next morning on your phone, so you can tap it on TSA terminal and walk through. So that instant nature of that product issuance is there. Or if you are disabled and you couldn't take a selfie, or you know, you can go in person or get, you know, in-person services and get that identity that way. You can also get services for like aged or aged folks as well, who don't care or can't figure out how to use their phones. So from equity standpoint, we have also created the in-person issuance experience, which is unique to California. Not many states have offered that. We have a very unique and fraud preventing binding to the physical person, to the physical phone. So there's a lot of tech involved in that as well.
Yeah. No, that's fantastic. Ajay, you have also reduced specialized plate approvals with AI, right? Mm-hmm. Walk our audience who are, you know, looking at the whole workflow from model training to human in the loop review. How did you do that? Walk our audience through that.
Yeah.
And explain what specialized, because we have global audience, they might not understand what specialized plate is.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I want to start by saying this is our model example of hyperautomation, where we have combined AI, machine learning, business process automation, and robotic process automation to achieve the level of automation we did. So let's start by what customized or specialized plates are. So customized plates in California, they're called environmental license plate for legacy reasons. But in general, if you want to really share a message with the world, like my friend, his name is Vinod, V-I-N-O-D. And he really liked the fact that he could reverse it and it'll be Dawn 5, right? And which is in Roman, right? So, or Dawn 4. So the thing that he would want from DMV is a license plate that has that letter on it. Otherwise, you get this somewhat random sequential plates, right? The first letter and three, or one character, three letters and few characters again, depending on the state you're in. So that's sequential plate. Customized plate is what you would want to say to the world. Some interesting messages come out of it, by the way. Some good ones. Examples are not coming to me right now, but like, you know, I am great, GRD, right? Somebody wants to say that. And as long as it's, let's call it socially acceptable, DMV would issue it. Now, we do get in trouble from time to time for issuing something that has a hidden meaning or becomes, unfortunately, a hidden meaning depending on the context. And the examples are out there related to like for example, 9/11, right? 9/11 would have been somebody's birthday in the past, and we may have issued something, but now if somebody's flaunting that plate, may not be considered something that's kosher in today's world, right? So those are some of the examples that are time sensitive. So we have to constantly be in touch with what's going on in the world and make sure that it's actually not bad for consumption, not just in English, but in other languages that are serviced across California. So that way, somebody who's, let's say, an Armenian, one of my roommates, she was Armenian, and she had this plate which essentially said Bizdig, which means like a little. She was driving a Volkswagen, a little Volkswagen, and that kind of fit, and there is no profanity, etc. in it. So it's a very tedious job for a DMV technician, a human, to get a request and then worry about whether it's acceptable, socially acceptable or not at the time the world exists, right? Yeah. So they would Google, they would look around. It'll take like minutes, if not sometimes like hours. And there is second review required sometimes because they're not really sure what this word means. So we started with our journey using like Google's BERT AI model with some profanity databases that we added. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to do okay. We knew that AI is not going to be able to solve this problem. So we would provide recommendation to the technician, and technician would take a relatively faster decision now. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to start by saying that we were 8 months behind on mm-hmm. processing. So that's our starting point. We were not happy with the throughput. There was a lot of backlog. There were some lawsuits to worry about, all that good stuff that, you know, typically you would see in this industry. And what we ended up doing was we introduced AI, which reduced the time for decision-making, keeping in mind that we always had human in the loop because we want to make sure the decision is still made by a human, but faster. Because now they are not Googling away and trying to figure it out. So from minutes, it went to seconds in terms of our verification process. And then that did well because it reduced our time using robotic process automation and AI and business process automation from 8 months to 2 weeks to zero backlog. Zero backlog doesn't mean you get it tomorrow, but it means the suppliers that actually manufacture it would get the information right away, right? So there is no backlog. Now, and then they can print it and we can ship it out. So that's still a few week cycle. We actually optimize that as well using AI. So that's for another day. But I can tell you that then we worried about all these other languages, etc. That's when LLM came out. And we realized that not the generative nature of the LLM that we were first interested in, but the fact that it was a large language model with all this information of the world in it, including other languages, by the way. It was able to give us an explainable score, not just saying that score is 0.3, 0.4, 0.5 on a scale of 1, that it has profanity, etc. But it would say profanity in German because of this word. Now we have explainability there, and it provides us legal grounds to stand on when we would reject somebody's request, saying that it's not a good request. And it would even do mirror image processing, right? Because some people are very creative. They will write something that in the mirror image would be profane, but not when you read it normally. So some of that analysis was also done by LLM, and our processing time got even better, but also more comprehensive because it covered multiple languages. It covered a vast variety of use cases.
Wow, what a fantastic use case. Trying to figure out if someone's, you know, you can get into legal trouble, social trouble, etc. across, because, you know, so many cultures, so many languages, so many within cultures also sometimes there is, you know, subtext that one has to. So would you say, this is just curiosity, and again, maybe it's too early, that it will reduce, obviously it's improved the turnaround, but it will reduce the, let's say, the lawsuits or something like that for you? Also?
Absolutely. The explainability part in my mind is been amazing. When we were using machine learning and AI, as you can imagine, deep machine learning gives you nothing in terms of explainability.
Yeah.
You're not even sure how computer got to that answer. It's a lot of statistics, but the path is not traced back. However, mm-hmm. with large language models, we've been able to get some amazing human readable explainability that we are able to utilize. So absolutely, I believe that we have more defensible argument in terms of decision making, but also ethically speaking, more responsible outcome, because now not only we are making a decision, but we have actually understood that decision that machine helped us make.
Yeah, no, that's a great example for your peers who are listening here. So Ajay, you have implemented, obviously we've talked about this, across diverse use cases, fraud detection, customer service chatbots. How, this is something that your peers want to know, how do you identify the right use cases for AI implementation in government? A lot of your, you know, federal CAIOs, chief AI officers and others are listening, and So they want to know, how do you identify the right use cases?
Yeah, it's a, I would say the question in my mind is very different. What tool would I use to solve a problem, whether it's AI or not, right? We always start with business problem definition. We always start with what type of quick wins can I get with the tools and technologies and processes that are available. We don't bank on, okay, well, I have blockchain, so let's just apply it anywhere I can. It's more of, here's a business problem. By the way, I know about the technology, and now I can put the two and two together. So more important thing is to stay as aware as possible. The pros and the cons, the good and the bad and the ugly of the technologies that are out there. So that way, when a business problem arises, you can match it to one, two, many, or even in stages that, yep, in first stage, I'm going to use robotic process automation. In second stage, I'm going to use AI. Third stage, I'm going to use a generative AI. And in fourth stage, fully automated, because now I have more deterministic decision-making and enough data, so I can actually create cheaper solutions. AI may not be the end goal. Actually, AI is predictive, as you all know, and was not as performant. So you may want to use it as a transition architecture and maybe not be the end architecture either, because end architecture may be more deterministic technologies that will get you the right answer, perhaps a rules engine. So as long as we have a set of accelerators, AI being one of them, and the business problems and match the two, that's how we do it. Not like, well, I have AI and I really want to look sexy and I'm going to find all that I can solve with AI. Usually that falls apart over time, because you may have a better solution sitting out there in your toolkit, which you may not be thinking about.
Yeah. So I think what you're saying is, first identify the business problem and then figure out which tool would fit best. It could be RPA, it could be Gen AI, it could be agentic AI, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's what you're saying. Ajay, so let's say if you picked a use case that needed an AI or a Gen AI or just AI solution, how do you measure the success and ROI of that initiative, especially in government where the metrics might be different from private sector? You know, the ROI in government probably is a little different than in private sector.
So that last part, I think we have tried to bring it in though. So it's same as private sector for us as well. Although we do have, like for example, who is competing with DMV, right, for the services? Nobody really. However, we have channels competing with each other, because some channels are more expensive than the other channels.
What do you mean by channels compete?
Okay, so when somebody visits a field office, it could cost us, and we have done activity-based costing for all these channels, field office, which is in-person visit, online channels, mail channels, kiosks, and voice channels, right? So for those delivery channels, it costs different, as you can imagine. When somebody calls our agent, it costs anything between $5 to $20. When they show up in the field office, anything from like $30 to $160, we have assigned minutes to dollars, right? Mail costs us close to between $3 to $5. Internet costs us $1.50, you know, stuff like that. So there is channel competition there. So in general, we worry about that. So in my mind, it's no different than private industry. Bottom line matters, top line matters. So in general, when we are making the decision, every single new innovation concept that we're bringing in, we actually start with this thing called a concept commitment. We commit to that concept. In that, we talk about what the cost of doing business as is, and what we believe the cost would be once we have taken a particular action. And we do this for every single automation that we, for the last 5 years at the DMV. So in my mind, it's no different than what we would do in private industry. In my mind, when we do execution commit and we worry about the AI, so there is some subjectivity though. Like for example, private industry may or may not worry about the ethics and explainability of AI, but we would. So there is some additional responsibility areas that we have to assign either a cost or weightage to in our decision-making. So that responsibility, the ethical use of certain technologies and tools involving unions when we do certain pieces of automation, making sure that they feel safe and secure in our decision-making. Also customers, so they don't feel like decisions are being made that are going to be machine only, and it's going to have inherent bias as well. So introducing human in the loop becomes part of our cost as well. We assign per unit cost to every single thing that we do. We assign adoption rate to call for success that within a certain period of time will have adoption, and therefore this will be the gains by end of that particular period, and then so on. And then we want to also not do what typically one would do, which is, okay, great, we have all this automation, but you need to carve out and extract the savings. You need to force it as well, whether it's a reduction in time, reduction in people, moving on, not from reduction in people like reducing the workforce, but moving the workforce to more productive areas of the organization so that we can tackle the next problem, next backlog issue, etc. So those are part of our roadmap when we start the journey. So I would say no different than private sector in our minds.
So really, as you said, it's no different than private sector per se. Ajay, let's, if we can now talk about something that's topic du jour, which is agentic AI and also AI models. So firstly, we did a big conference last week in Vegas, where we had over 8,000 people, and one of the panels was on agentic AI, and one of the questions that we asked was, how do you define AI agents? And believe me, there were five people on the panel, everybody had a different answer. So I want to kind of understand from you, what is your definition? And then I'll ask you a little, drill down a little more into, how is California evaluating agentic AI for workflows and things of that nature? So start off telling us, what is your definition?
Yeah, so, I've been working with chatbots for, I want to say now, between 12 to 13 years at this point in time. When Azure came there, Microsoft came with their framework, Google came with their framework, we got onto it and I implemented. At that point in time, I was with one of the big four firms, and we were looking at introducing chatbot. It was not a moneymaker for us, but it had the oomph to, get us into the door with a lot of our customers. So it was part of my innovation center's job to make sure that we were able to put something together. At that point in time, we had already come up with this notion of these AI entities, let's call them that, not use the word agent for a second, that would provide answers to questions, make decisions, and then take action. Those are the three areas. Answer to question, make decision, and take action. So answers to question is standard, your Q&A bots that are out there in the world. The cool thing about it is now you don't need to curate the answer. Generative AI can generate the answer for you, hopefully with some guardrails around hallucinations. Decision is the reasoning technologies that are now being introduced with the generative AI that you can think of. There's a lot more work to be done in that space. I'm not an expert in that space, but based on the study I've done, that reasoning engines need a whole lot more work. But you can actually integrate AI with rules engines and get similar results as well, as long as you know your business and its deterministic answers. Then comes in ability to take action. That's where the agentic AI comes in, where you have specific actions served by these agents, whether it's creating a ticket, resetting the password, resetting your infrastructure when infrastructure thresholds have reached certain levels. So those actions are now, based on the decisions, in my mind, are the agentic AI components. We have already been doing that at DMV. On our DMV call center, we have this agent called Miles. It works on both web and also voice. So it has text-to-speech, speech-to-text, all that good stuff, language translation on the go. So it's decent. It didn't use Gen AI, But the notion of agentic AI minus the gen part was always there, because we do have some service fulfillment pieces where customer would ask certain questions, we route them to certain fulfillment agents. We used to call them specialized agents or specialized bots, and they would serve that particular answer. With the advent of Gen AI, getting the answer, getting to the right solution that's already available and take that particular action has been much easier with the technology like, you know, MCP and others that makes it easier to get to the right context and really play that particular context and get the answer. So in my mind, that's what is agentic AI, and we are already doing it in a way.
Fantastic. So I think what you've told our listeners is an agentic AI, which is outcome driven or goal driven, which is going to take decisions, is what an agentic AI or an agent is, according to you. Autonomous decision.
Take an action, right? Beyond
taken
the decision,
an action take an or action. A, to take an action towards a certain outcome or a goal, right?
That's right.
Great. And you're already using some of those agents within in California in the government?
We're using the specialized bots that actually provide the agentic AI or meets the requirements of agentic AI. It's not using Gen AI at this point in time. We're going through the rigor with our CIO's office to make sure that we're able to now introduce Gen AI to service our customers. We have recently introduced it for our technicians, internal only, so that technicians can be better productive in terms of looking for information, going through policy documents, figuring out how to service this very special customer from out of country with a very specific problem. How do we service them, right? Not all the technicians know all the policies. So we have a policy guru that's been released that uses some of these features as well. And then for our customer-facing interactive agent, we have these specialty bots that essentially serve as these agents and provide specialty service to our customers, but not using Gen AI, not at the moment.
Ajay, thinking broader, with especially with your background, what do you see agentic AI playing a big role in what you're doing? And where is it safe and high value to implement an agent, and where would you not deploy agents yet?
Yeah, I think the same rules apply for me in terms of applying these tools, which is be on the cautious side, make sure the actions and decisions are as mechanical as you get as a starting point, meaning there is no gray area. As soon as you introduce probability into the mix, you can introduce a bad decision-making as well. So our goal is to try it for less impact use cases. So the decision is not going to hurt the customer. Decision is not going to take away work from our employees and so on. It's merely expanding our service scope. For example, if it's a 24/7 service for the hours that are not serviced by our technicians, we introduce some of these agentic AIs will perhaps create a case for us or queue up something or provide more meaningful information to the customer. So when they come in next and really want to talk to a human, can they come in better prepared or just be done? Because we have actually given them access to another channel that provides that answer and those actions to them. For things that require decision-making and impacts eligibility for our customers, et cetera, we have to start with human in the loop. We have to identify patterns that are become more mechanical, even though it's thinking, but that thinking is more repeat. We would, as public sector entity, be more comfortable introducing those, right? Disadvantaging, because we are a public sector entity, we need to make sure that it's level playing field for everybody. Our decisions are consistent and they're also per the policies that are laid out, per the regulations that are available. So we cannot afford hallucinations. We have to have guardrails in place. We are actually testing multiple ways to implement the guardrails. It may either create more friction or reduce the level of service that the customer is going to get, but it will be fair and equitable and without hallucination. So those are some of the things that we are always worried about introducing some of these, the agentic AI technologies. Now, in my mind, it will be used for things that are either going to aid our technicians to reduce the call time, reduce the interaction time so that customer can get the information better, or in case of a direct customer interaction, provide meaningful but not detrimental decisions to the customer, so that way customers are not disadvantaged in case we found, let's call it, probabilistic issues with the AI outcomes.
No, so I think what you're saying to our listeners is you're going to be using agentic AI to expand services, which, let's say, the weekend is not covered. So now you have an opportunity to cover the weekend or to provide some additional maybe services that maybe are not being provided due to whatever reason. I think what you're saying is it gives you an ability to expand services, maybe even improve services, I think is what you're saying, Ajay. But for human decision making, there will always be a human in the loop. Now, you touched upon something, the guardrails. So when you think about guardrails, and, you know, we have conversations with, you know, a lot of your peers, etc. In your office, how do you make sure, I mean, there's, you know, the data security, you deal with a lot of, as you said, almost, you know, 35 plus million people and their identities. I mean, if you were an e-commerce platform, you'd be one of the bigger e-commerce platforms in the world because, you know, you're doing some of these things. So how do you make sure it's not just obviously data security, responsible AI, making sure from an ethics and that perspective, how is there some kind of a governance structure that is put in place here?
So there's so many questions in it, what you just asked for. So starting from the backside of it, number one, we do have the governance structure in terms of, first of all, assessing an opportunity, making sure there is ROI, making sure we are not going for the next sexy thing, right? Making sure we use taxpayers' money well. We assess it for return on the investment and also total cost of ownership to be able to implement certain things. We also assess it for us as the policymakers that we actually ourselves comply to the policy as well. So all the opportunities are assessed for some of those benchmarks that are out there. It has to be, in a way, cash positive. It has to be compliant and meets the regulatory and legal standards that are out there. In terms of our ability to implement the guardrails, there's the technical guardrails, process guardrails, you know, governance guardrails as well. So the first part covers the governance guardrails. From technical guardrails standpoint, we are using multiple tech. For example, if you want to use one LLM output to verify another LLM's output, that's kind of like a common theme that's used as well. Certain, let's call it, it's more data-centric, but essentially using the information we have already collected about our customers in terms of what they ask, and then feeding that to see what the answers would be, more of a regression analysis of the models as we improve our models or update our models, is always performed. So we always have a benchmark to set. So we are not degrading our services, which may be working now, but you upgrade certain things or modify the model, it's no longer working. So those are some of the tools that we use as well. And obviously we look for customer feedback, right? Net promoter scores, CSAT scores, et cetera, to make sure that we take that feedback as soon as possible and implement it. So more customers are not impacted as well. We get like 35 to 40 million visitors a year annually on our website. A lot of them use our chatbots. It's something that we really worry about on day-to-day basis. So, and then there is other guardrails. For example, Microsoft and AWS and Google have come up with their own inherent guardrails on top of the existing LLMs that they are hosting. So we have started to take advantage of that as well and still playing with to make sure that those actually work and work to our satisfaction. So that's in play as well. From process guardrail standpoint, we are actually constantly reviewing the feedback that has been given, and we have a baseline of utterances available and the solutions, what we call as answers, available to us. So in my mind, not just to improve the accuracy, but also to reduce cost related to GenAI, the goal is that as we get understanding of what the customer is looking for, we may not leave some of those repeat things into generative AI anymore. We may just have pre-generated answers, which actually essentially a caching of sorts. So that way, you're not spending money on tokens for every single answer that perhaps is the same answer for millions of the customers because of a hot topic that's out there. We'll create a deterministic answer, pass through the deterministic engine, and then take it to GenAI for everything else that it knows, right? So those are some of the strategies we are using to implement more guardrails.
Oh, fantastic. You've got a lot of things in place, policy guardrails, technology guardrails, process guardrails, etc. Ajay, one of the questions from your peers is that new models are rolling out in waves, closed and open. You know, GPT-5 just came out, you know, Claude, Grok. What kind of evaluation criteria or rubric do you use to figure out whether it's for, you know, open or closed, or whether it's, you talked about, you know, like accuracy, latency, TCO, total cost of ownership, etc. And how do you kind of figure out what which ones to use?
Yeah, so I think third-party benchmarks are a starting point for us. Comparing the models. So we are never really taking the latest model as it comes out. I think, you know, that doesn't really work for us. We do have sort of a wait time for us where third parties can have opinions on the models and the features that are out there. And out of a matrix of like multimodal and language processing and a few other things, there's only a few that matter to us, depending on the use case. Those are the things that we really focus on. Now, even in third parties, there is bias. So we need to look at multiple third parties on who prefers Anthropic models versus OpenAI models versus, you know, Google Gemini models and AWS models as well. It's a bit of a subjective analysis, but more based on multiple sources of information. On top of that, we also have our own kind of like regression analysis tooling that we want to make sure that actually works for our particular business need and works for the status quo. So we have status quo model testing that we would perform before we would accept a particular model, if that makes sense. So those are some of the tooling that we use at the moment.
Great. Benchmarking, figuring out what's best from, you know, different models that are given to you, the tooling that you do. Let's just talk a little bit about talent, because you're in California, right in the thick of the AI talent wars, as they say. In this kind of a situation, how do you, as a public sector entity, attract top tier, ML data engineers to come in and work? Or what has worked for you? This is again a question from your peers. Do you reskill civil servants into prompt engineers, or how do you do that? What is your talent strategy?
Yeah, sorry, pause. I'm going to turn the, there you go. My lights turned off. Okay. Resume. So yeah, good question, Sanjay. My approach is multifaceted. It's build, buy, borrow strategy in terms of just getting the talent for pretty much anything that I do. And this is no different, except the borrow part actually has a lot of public-private partnership, not just like get people hired from the industry to help, which we do. We have specific subject matter expert that I've hired to help me evaluate things. But I also borrow using public-private partnership. There is a lot of willing private entities, you know, name the digital giants. They are willing and interested in public sector use cases, and then come and try things out with us. So, and we are welcoming that partnership. So that's the strategy. So in terms of the talent, it's primarily through that channel, because as you can imagine, the industry is evolving. What the being at the DMV gives me personally the privilege to interact with the product managers of those evolving startups and the companies. They invite us. They're very willing and interested because they know we are one of the biggest, and they know that they could learn from what our needs are to make their products better. So that partnership and their willingness to engage has been a privilege for us to take advantage of, and we are trying to take advantage of as much as we can. And then in the same fashion, people who are passionate have come in and worked for us because they've realized through, there is a reason why I'm doing this podcast, because I want to hear the world here, for the world to hear out what we are doing, and for people to get interested and reach out to us, whether they want to just be partners, both commercial partners or just partners in intellectual investigations, academia, etc., which we also are engaged with quite a bit, a lot of engaged academic engagement as well, or just work with us, right, as somebody who's interested in, even for a small period of time, we will make it your money's worth for you to come and share your talent to give you real life experience of a very large set of problems to solve.
So Ajay, I'm going to make a plug for you, because that's one of the key purposes of our podcast is, so it could be in academia, it could be startups with innovative ideas, or it could be somebody talented looking like you to do public service work and wants to come in. You are open to hear from all of the above, right?
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Ajay, for the folks, and there are a lot of them who are listening, is there, what are the one or two or three skills that you look for when you hire someone? So if, who are listening, they can figure out if they are a good fit for you.
I think it depends on the type of journey, but in general, I think the for anybody who I would hire, the right attitude in terms of the curiosity and the learning is extremely important, because even if you come in with your toolkit and talent, there is always something new or different. And if you're set in your ways, it kind of blinds you to the your way of doing certain things. So that openness to learning has been extremely critical for me as well, right? I mean, it's extremely critical for me to have that open mind. And absolutely putting in 100% commitment. Those are kind of like the human side of things. In terms of the technology side of things, like I said, we are not here to take AI and solve, find problems to solve. We are here to look for a plethora of toolkits. So essentially anybody with a toolkit, even if it's specialized enough, as long as you know that it will match only certain things, is welcome. Expertise obviously is extremely appreciated. Somebody with a large network of like your friends in academia and whatever, you can get us to the right answer. They're always appreciated. So it's really everything, but more importantly, the aptitude to be curious, to learn, and to put in your 100% has always been my preference for my team members.
So for our listeners, attitude and aptitude to learn, and also a network across the board, whether it's in academia and others, I think is what Ajay is looking for. Ajay, finally, California has won multiple international awards for innovation under your leadership. What do you think sets your approach apart from other, you know, government digital transformation efforts? This is for your peers. What would be your message to other chief AI officers in the federal government, state government, or even companies? What has worked? And, you know, you have been recognized for a lot of innovation under your leadership. Why is that?
I think part of it is just our willingness to try. We are constantly moving. We are not talking and thinking, but doing. And that has given us a whole lot of leverage, because while people are talking about certain things, we are trying those things. And there is, things would fail, and that's okay. So that tolerance and that sort of reasonable risk is extremely critical for us to keep moving and wanting to do stuff rather than talking about it for a while. For my peers, I think that's probably the biggest feedback. Go do it. Try it. Make sure you have the right people looking at things. But most importantly, just constantly be curious on what's available. Match the problem to the solution. But go try it. I think that's been the biggest difference for us. That's why it's been the most exhausting job for me, but most meaningful, because I'm constantly trying. I have hundreds of business problems to solve for Californians, and I'm constantly trying and evolving, but we are not sitting for somebody else to come in and solve it for us. We are asking for help. We do these vendor days. We're asking these startups, these big companies to come in. Here's the problem. How would you solve it? We take ideas from them. We also engage them directly and then solve it together at times, but we are not waiting for anybody to come and help us do it or come and do it for us, but come and help us do it together.
Yeah, fantastic. I think what Ajay's motto is, maybe Nike stole his motto, just do it, motto. And I never thought, somebody in the public sector says, we just want to do it. We are open to partners. We are open to listening. It's what a refreshing, and you know, state of California is truly lucky to have someone like you. Ajay, is RealID integrated with your license now in some shape or form?
Yeah, so we obviously have RealID as part of the federal requirement. We are probably at about, out of the 34 million identities, close to 20 million have RealIDs, but mobile driver license is also, we were the first fully compliant state for mobile driver licenses as well, as it relates to RealID. We are the first one before the May 7th deadline hit. We were compliant, fully compliant, not just have a plan to be compliant, because TSA did allow for that, that tolerance as well. We were fully compliant with no pending things to worry about.
Awesome. Ajay, at the end, we do this quick lightning round just to, change things around. We've had some pretty intense conversation on some very important subjects. So just one word answers. You ready?
Yep, I'm ready.
You're always ready. Okay, Ajay. Cloud or on-prem?
Cloud.
This is all about AI.
Cloud.
Python or R?
Python, because I'll find more Gen Zs with that skill than R.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay. Supervised or unsupervised learning?
Supervised just because we are a public entity. So, yeah.
Open source or proprietary?
Open source, absolutely. We were actually one of the first ones to open source our wallet as well, by the way. So, absolutely in favor of that.
Fantastic. This will make things a little tricky for you. In-house or external AI talent?
You're right. It is tricky. I would say external, because I'm not complacent on that. We'll have the know-how for this very rapidly evolving field.
Okay. Explainable AI or performance optimization?
See, I don't know if they are either or. I want both, because they're not even in the same boat. So I want explainable and I want performant. But explainable doesn't mean that it's going to be slow, right? So yeah. I would want both.
Okay. This is unique to you. Hackathons or traditional RFPs?
Absolutely hackathons.
And you've done both. You've done both, by the way.
We have done both. But I prefer, in fact, California governor came up with this innovative approach called RFI squared, which is kind of in line with the hackathon style. But I actually have done real pure hackathons. Last October and November, we did two hackathons, one for commercial and one for governments only, with federal international entities that came in. So absolutely a fan of hackathons.
Awesome. I think that was great. Ajay, it's been absolutely fascinating to hear really about your journey and the groundbreaking work you really are doing in California. Think about it. People with digital licenses, I'm carrying my Virginia plastic card still. And your approach to implementing in AI and government services is really setting a new standard. It's, like I said, listening to you, you this, I might be listening to Amazon or some other e-commerce platform turning around customer sat, all those things. And you bridge your private sector and public sector, and you're bringing enterprise level AI innovation to serve millions of citizens, whether they have accessibility issues, digital stuff, etc. And that, I think, is very important. And for our listeners, you know, Ajay's journey demonstrates that some of the most impactful and challenging AI work is happening in the public sector. People don't realize it, but it is truly happening in the public sector. And whether you're an aspiring chief AI officer or AI professional considering government work, Ajay's experience shows that you can drive real innovation while serving the public good. So reach out to him if you feel you can help. Thank you, Ajay, for what you do, and thank you for joining us on our podcast.
Sanjay, the questions have been amazing, and this was a fun interaction. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And I can tell you that being on a panel with State of Virginia in the past in Washington, D.C., that it's coming to you very soon, the mobile driver.
Okay. Well, maybe then we'll have the digital chief digital officer from Virginia. I'm not taking a shot at Virginia, please. This was just talking about the great work you're doing. But thanks again, Ajay. Thank you for being on the podcast.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks, Sanjay.
Thank you.